Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, plutonium may be coming to a nuclear power plant near you. The U.S. has 50 surplus tons of it left over from the Cold War, and one option being considered is to get rid of it in civilian reactors. It's become popular to see the Grand Canyon from an airplane, but the noise changes the experience for everyone on the ground. We'll hear a locking horns debate about whether flights should be further restricted. Road salt saves lives and kills trees. Is there a better way to save people and the trees as well? We'll talk green about it. And in our Earth calendar, we go to the most biologically rich place on Earth, where the weather never changes. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Good news. The end of the Cold War is leading to the dismantling of large numbers of atomic weapons. But there are problems. Specifically, what to do with the plutonium once used in nuclear warheads. The U.S. Department of Energy has proposed two methods for disposal, but environmentalists and the nuclear industry disagree on which one should be pursued. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports that a nuclear power plant near you may one day use surplus plutonium.
Plutonium is often called the deadliest substance on Earth. Just a tiny bit of it will kill you, and with it, terrorists could make bombs to wipe out whole cities. The U.S. Department of Energy, which could not provide a spokesperson for this story, has the unenviable task of figuring out what to do with 50 tons of surplus plutonium. They've proposed two options. One is to use plutonium in civilian nuclear reactors. The other is called vitrification, which would mix plutonium with molten glass before storing it away. Steve Unglesby is with the industry-backed Nuclear Energy Institute.
The nuclear industry supports DOE's dual-track strategy for the very simple reasons that it doesn't put all your eggs in one basket, in one technology. The dual-track strategy also allows for the timely startup of a plutonium disposal program here in the United States. From a diplomatic standpoint, is that it shows, particularly the Russians, that we are serious and committed about getting our disposal program off the ground and underway as soon as possible.
But many environmentalists are concerned that using plutonium in civilian reactors, like the ones used by many utility companies all around the country, sets a dangerous precedent. If plutonium were used in reactors, it would be mixed with uranium and turned into something called MOX, which stands for mixed oxide fuel. Mary Olson is with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, an environmental group. She says MOX is too dangerous.
Our position is that both vitrification and mixed oxide fuel are experimental. However, the stakes of using MOX in our reactors is so much higher that we oppose pursuing that option, and we're optimistic that there will be ways to overcome any technical problems with making plutonium inaccessible for use in warheads with existing technology like vitrification or immobilization in ceramics. That would be a backup if there are insurmountable problems in vitrification. So we don't see that the reactor option is needed even for backup.
Besides the safety and environmental issues, there's also a question of whether the MOX option is economically feasible, and if not, why are we using it? Arjun Makajani is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He says if the U.S. pursues the MOX option, it will put pressure on Russia, which has mountains of their own surplus plutonium.
And the physics tells you that plutonium is a fuel that can be used in nuclear reactors. The economics is against you. Even if the plutonium is free, if it is donated by the weapons program to the reactors, plutonium is so difficult to manage and so hard to process that the processing cost alone makes plutonium fuel much more expensive than uranium fuel. And if the United States goes the route of using plutonium in its power plants, certainly Russia is going to do the same. Currently, they don't have the money to go that route. And I believe that it would be really wrong to arrive at agreements with Russia that give them the enable them or help them to build factories to use plutonium as a fuel, because it's putting plutonium into circulation, putting it into more places, using it in more reactors, and creating more opportunities for diversion or theft, and also perpetuating the production of plutonium. So the problem is very, very complicated, and it's time to put an end to the plutonium era, not to perpetuate it.
The nuclear industry admits that neither vitrification nor the MOX option is perfect. Steve Unglesby from the Nuclear Energy Institute says eventually the science will point to which option works best.
DOE itself has said that we need to pursue both the MOX fuel technology and vitrification, because one technology can serve as a backup to the other if for some reason a technology is delayed or found unsuitable. But the biggest advantage of using plutonium in nuclear power plants is that it consumes a large portion of the plutonium, renders the remainder unsuitable ever again for nuclear weapons, and taps plutonium's enormous energy value. It's the only technology that will do all three of those things.
But Mary Olson says the MOX option amounts to corporate welfare. The Department of Energy would likely pay utilities to take the MOX, as well as pay for equipment upgrades, worker training, and more. Meanwhile, the electricity generated would go into utility coffers. Olson says that's not fair.
Here we have a situation where the nuclear utilities are going to be facing competition with other forms of energy today. Wind and gas turbine and some of the other options are coming in at about 3 cents a kilowatt hour. The national average for nuclear power is 12 cents a kilowatt hour. The Department of Energy would have to subsidize a MOX burning reactor to the level where it could compete with its stiffest competition in order for it to stay open under utility deregulation. This is not only corporate welfare, it is basically federal investment in nuclear power.
Olson says this proposal simply breathes a last gasp into an industry on the ropes. Electricity will soon be deregulated, exposing the nuclear industry to competition from the free market. But Steve Unglesby contends nuclear power is competitive.
Restructuring of the electric utility industry will happen within the next 4 to 5 years. That's well in advance of the possibility of using mixed oxide fuel in nuclear power plants. So any plants that are not competitive in a restructured electric marketplace will have gone by the wayside by the time MOX is available to use in those plants.
MOX has been used in parts of Europe for over 20 years. Still, environmentalists say it's time to scrap any plan that puts more plutonium into circulation. They say the risk to both the environment and national security is too high. Unfortunately, this is only one issue out of many we'll have to deal with from our nuclear heritage. The U.S. effectively has no place to dispose of its nuclear waste, and many of the sites once used to build nuclear bombs are still badly contaminated. These issues, put off for many years, are expected to take center stage over the next decade. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
If you have an opinion on the environment, we want to hear from you. Call and talk to one of our producers. You can ask your question on the air in our Talking Green segment. Call us at our new toll-free number. It's 888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can also order copies of this Environment Show. The number is 369. Visitors to the Grand Canyon have found it's no place for solitude because of the number of sightseers buzzing around in airplanes. In 1987, the Congress told the Federal Aviation Administration to put rules in effect to reduce airplane noise over the canyon. Last month, the Clinton administration announced new rules which would further restrict flying over the canyon, and environmentalists have gone to court arguing the rules are not strict enough. The air tour operators are also in court, saying the rules are too strict. The underlying question, then, is whether the 1987 rules that have been in effect are adequate. We're joined by Jim Petty of the Air Tour Association, which represents the companies conducting air tours, and he's in Las Vegas, Nevada. Jeff Bernard is president of the Grand Canyon Trust, an environmental organization, and he's in Grand Canyon, Arizona. They lock horns over the question, does the current rule meet the 1987 congressional mandate to effect substantial restoration of natural quiet in the Grand Canyon? Jeff Bernard?
Well, since 1987, when Congress passed the original law, the situation has only gotten worse over the Grand Canyon. The number of flights has almost doubled, and now I don't think many people would realize, but there's 70, 80,000 overflights annually over the Grand Canyon. The current rule doesn't restore natural quiet, and so an additional, tougher rule had to be mandated, and that's what's come out at the end of 1996 here. We don't think that rule goes even stronger, and far enough, and needs to be stronger. The basic problem is that the rule must limit the total number of flights allowed over the Grand Canyon each year. Without a limit, the problem will just continue to get worse. The problem is the noise from aircraft in the air over the canyons, and if you have more aircraft, you're going to have more noise, and that's just a simple equation.
Jim Petty, in reply.
Well, Jeff points out the increased traffic has increased over the canyon since 87. And that was taken in design when the implementation of the present regulations were put into place. And by that, the regulations stated that the tour routes would go into unpopulated areas and away from most of the visitors in the park. And the FAA was mandated to do two things, create a safe environment and create one that was environmentally friendly to all users of the parks, including the air tour users. So what they did was design a lengthy, complicated route structure that put the airplanes not in direct competition with the majority of the ground visitors. And we think it's been very effective because there's never been an accident in the regulated airspace, so they created the safety issue was taken care of. And as far as the visitor impact and the quiet, visitor complaints were reduced by 92% since 87.
Okay. Jeff Bernard responding.
Well, we don't manage the parks simply by complaints, by suggestion box. The national parks are special places. We're charged with managing them and keeping them for all who come in the future. And there are a lot of uses of the parks that we can't hear or smell, or potential uses of the park, like decreased visibility, pollution, water quality that you can't see or smell or hear, but we don't allow those in the parks either. The parks are special places and have to be managed for the long term and not allow just anything to go on there.
Jim Petty, the last word.
We agree with that, but we believe that the parks are for all people, and they should not be left to just a few of the elite who may be able to hike 50 miles away. We don't fly within 50 miles of the populated areas of the park. That's by design. We think the regulations as they are intact. The regulated airspace is the most regulated in the world, and it's working very well.
Jim Petty is with the Air Tour Association, and Jeff Barnard is with the Grand Canyon National Trust. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking Green on the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about road salt, salt spread on highways to cut ice and make driving safer. Anywhere between 10 and 18 million tons of salt are spread each winter on American highways. While this may reduce ice on the roads, the salt also affects vegetation and water quality. In some areas, salt use is being reduced to save the environment, and people say this puts lives at stake. What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. We're joined by three experts. They're Keith Cherryholmes from the State Water Quality Division of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in St. Paul, Minnesota. Maynard Bowers, a botanist from Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan. And Joe Doherty from the New York State Department of Transportation in Albany, New York. Maynard Bowers, let's start with you. As a botanist, how much damage does road salt do to the environment?
It does a pretty fair amount to the trees and shrubbery along the roadsides. But in the work that I have done with it, it seems to come primarily from the salt spray from the highways, acting as somewhat like a contact dermatitis. That is, it is burning the needles, the twigs. It is causing a reduction in the photosynthesis, which in turn then just continues the browning.
So, Joe Doherty, in New York, do you modify your use of salt as a result of the environmental impact, or do you figure this is just part of doing business?
Well, the single biggest change that we had was a little over 10 years ago. The majority of the complaints, environmental complaints, we had were related to our stockpiles. And we switched to a covered stockpile program over 10 years ago, and that dramatically decreased the amount of impact we thought we were having on the environment.
So this was a problem of the stuff just running off the piles which you had
real
stacked up around the road.
Real concentrated piles in the vicinities of where those piles used to be located. Now we're all undercover. We're on impermeable pads. We manage the snow piles a lot better. We also have, we've taken a lot of steps to try to reduce the amount of salt we use on the roads themselves. We've switched to an anti-icing program, which came out of a national study a few years ago, where if you get out early in a storm, you can actually prevent the ice from forming on the highway instead of having to burn it off afterwards. So if you, with a timely response, you can reduce the overall amount of salt. Sort of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Keith Cherryholmes, how have you approached this problem in Minnesota?
Well, we have worked closely with the Minnesota Department of Transportation as well as Department of Natural Resources to use salt wisely. And as Joe Doherty was just saying, one of the things that we see as a real problem is the stockpiles. They're almost like a point source discharge, very concentrated, and they do have a great deal of impact. Whereas the road salt, after it's been applied and collected in our storm sewers, a dilution factor is always taken into consideration as it is discharged into a receiving water, such as the Mississippi River. It runs through town here. So it minimizes the impact.
And so going back to you, Mr. Bowers, if the problems relate to a small stretch along the highway, is the concern about environmental pollution of salt and the use on the highways, is that been overstated by the environmental community?
No, I don't think so, because as already been mentioned by the others, there is a runoff, and this is getting into the streams and, in our area, of course, into the Great Lakes, which is a problem because it is changing the chemistry of the lakes. Therefore, it is changing the type of life within the entry area. So it is a big problem that really needs more looking at.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones, and I see we have a call from Greenwich, New York. Bonnie, you're
actually
on the air and talking
it's,
green.
It's Shushan now. It's Greenwich, not Greenwich, but now I'm in Shushan.
Okay.
Just to clarify for a moment, and we're on the beautiful Baton Kill here in southern Washington County, and, of course, these are issues that are near and dear to our hearts. I don't think that the public generally understands how our watersheds work, and they think that, at least in my teaching, and they think that what goes on the road doesn't stray far. I think it would really behoove us to help our populace understand that there is a really broad effect. Also, the combination of salt with whatever else might be going on the soil or on the roads, the bioaccumulation, the combined effects of certain relatively benign substances, how they can combine and become treacherous.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
Anything?
Yes, it does. And let me ask those of you in the transportation business, how much impact the use of salt really has in terms of safety?
Well, this is Joe Doherty. We had seen some national studies. Marquette University did some groundbreaking work on, you know, the effects of on accident rates based on the application of salt. And they saw, you know, very dramatic decreases in the period immediately following application. As soon as you apply the salt and you start to get some of the friction capability of the pavement back, the number of accidents drop off dramatically. And that's one of the kind of the landmark studies that a lot of transportation agencies look at when they, and in addition to our own, you know, sort of experience and our own reports from the field on kind of anecdotal information.
Well, I'm afraid our time is up, and I want to thank you all and our callers. We've been visited by Keith Cherryholmes from the Water Quality Division of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in St. Paul. Maynard Bowers, a botanist from Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan, and Joe Doherty from the New York State Department of Transportation in Albany, New York, talking green on the Environment Show. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Give us a call and let's hear from you. Thanks a lot. In our Earth calendar, we look at a natural event that is occurring as we broadcast. It's a chance to explore the rhythms of climate, the cycles of life, those things that make our Earth such an interesting place. Usually, it's change that comes to our attention, such as a flowering, a shift of season, or a migration. Today, we go to the northeast part of the rainforest in the Amazon basin in Peru. The unique thing about that ecosystem is that the climate there doesn't change at all. Roger Mustalish is the president of the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research, which maintains a station in Iquitos, Peru.
Right now in Peru, in the Amazon Basin, it's we're well into summer. And in summer, though, in the northeastern part of Peru, it really doesn't look much different than winter or fall or spring. We're a few degrees south of the equator. And as a result of it, our days are 12 hours of light and 12 hours of darkness. Temperature is usually around 87 degrees all the time. And the humidity is also around 87-90%, with any given day likely to bring some rainfall. In fact, if you were to look at the area that we're in, some scientists look at it as almost like a golden triangle of biodiversity, because from an area from southern Ecuador over to Colombia and then down into our part of Peru, these conditions of constant heat and rainfall and equal lighting has stimulated some of the highest biodiversity of plant and animal species found anywhere on the planet. And they attribute it to this similarity, to this constancy of temperature and lighting and moisture. And I can give you a real quick example as to some of the unique life forms that exist in a place like this. We have a site very close to our station in Peru where you can stand in the middle of a 2.5-acre parcel and look at 300 different tree species. And botanists have identified that as the most botanically rich area on the entire planet.
But even in this place where the climate and length of day is always the same, change comes about from things that happen elsewhere. Mustalish said that when he left last week, the river had started its annual rise and already was up 15 feet, since summer is melting the snow in the Andes Mountains to the west. Apparently, there are changes taking place outside of this golden triangle of biodiversity, which may change the annual floods which nourish it.
Even though our area is not being heavily deforested, areas in the Andes and areas in Brazil are. And what we're starting to see now is that with deforestation in the Andes, the floodwater is becoming more and more severe. And that's going to start to impact even our area by having flood in areas that typically has not occurred. This could disrupt everything from these feeding patterns of fish and dolphin. It also could start to stress out some of the terrestrial trees that really can't stand that level of inundation. In addition, in Brazil, where there's a lot of deforestation taking place, we're now starting to see some impacts in the amount of rainfall. And if that were to start to happen, then we run the opposite risk of when you're in the time of the year where there's not a lot of floods and we're in a typically low water area time of the year. We may actually be seeing now that because of low rainfall patterns that the water is even lower than it should be. This then will likely have an impact on everything from food supplies for fish and dolphin, as well as the ability of the rivers to nourish the surrounding islands and the surrounding land that people are relying on for agriculture.
Roger Mustalish is the president of the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research Foundation. I guess the moral of a tale is that even if the climate doesn't change in your own forest, you may not be able to save it without protecting the trees somewhere else. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, bioengineers have been transferring genes from one form of life to another. They've learned how to take the gene back out again after it's done its work. We'll talk green about electric cars. They've hit the U.S. market, but should you buy one? Are they all they're charged up to be? Author Thomas Power says mining, ranching, and logging don't make any sense in the New West. And singer-songwriter Bruce Coburn wonders if anyone hears the trees fall in the rainforest. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Last summer, a patent was issued on a process called controlled modification of the eukaryotic genome. The process was developed by Tom Hodges, professor of plant physiology at Purdue University. Despite its intimidating name, it's a process that may have a lot to do with the way we feed ourselves and use pesticides and herbicides in the future. Specifically, it has to do with taking genes out of plants that were previously inserted by the bioengineer. Professor Hodges describes what he's done.
We've done two things. One is we have developed a procedure for inserting genes into specific places in the chromosome, and we've also developed a way of removing or excising the transgenes that we've put in. The first part of it, the insertion of genes into specific places, is still very difficult. We can do it, but it's at a very low efficiency. The more important parameter at the present time is our ability to remove genes once we've put them in and used them for a specific purpose.
So explain that to me. You put the gene in so that a plant has certain characteristics.
Right.
And then why would you want to remove it after that process has taken place?
Okay, that's a very good question. Generally, when one puts genes, foreign genes, into plants, you put in at least two. One of them is generally an antibiotic resistance gene, and the other gene is a gene of interest, such as it provides insect resistance or herbicide resistance or virus resistance. The reason for putting in the antibiotic resistance gene is it's a tag that lets you find out which cells of the plant have been transformed, and you basically kill all the others. So this, the use of the antibiotic resistance gene is just a convenient tool for identifying the cells that have been genetically altered. But as you now have a plant, and this transgenic plant dies and gets incorporated back into the soil, that antibiotic resistance gene, as well as the other gene, is still present. And there's a possibility, not a very high one, but there is a possibility that microorganisms could acquire that gene and become resistant to the antibiotic. And so it would be nice if you could remove that gene and break it down, the antibiotic resistance gene, before the plant died.
Hodges sees use of his process in rice growing. The short of it is that a gene can be put in rice that makes the plant able to survive a particular weed killer. The rice is planted, the weed killer is applied, and then the gene is removed before it can spread to weeds and give them resistance to the weed killer.
There are a lot of weeds that are very close relatives of the major crop plants. And one good example is rice, which is grown in the western part of the United States and the southern part of the United States. And there is a weed called red rice. that is the same genus and species as regular rice. And people are developing herbicide-resistant rice. And there's almost a 100% chance that the pollen from the transgenic rice will move into the red rice and fertilize the red rice plant. And when that happens, one will develop herbicide-resistant red rice, the weed. And so what would be nice would be if we could put in the herbicide-resistant gene, spray the rice fields with the herbicide that is being used, and then at a later stage remove that herbicide-resistant rice before it gets into the pollen and could have the chance to move into the red rice.
Hodges says the way the implanted gene is removed is to put in another gene, which when triggered starts a process that destroys the first gene. The trigger mechanism could be a natural change that takes place in the growing of the plant, like pollen production. Or it could be a chemically controlled gene promoter. That's a chemical which would be sprayed on the plant by the farmer. Another application of the process is in the production of hybrid corn seed. Now, in making a hybrid, many seed producers take the tassels off corn by hand. That costs about $100 million a year. Using Hodges' technique, the corn plant can be engineered to excise its sterility gene by itself at the appropriate stage of its development, and the need for detasseling by hand is eliminated. As genetic engineering gets more and more sophisticated, the environmental and commercial implications are huge. Food crops with genetic resistance to disease and insects may be produced with less chemicals. Crops engineered to grow through certain weed killers may result in an increase in the use of certain chemical herbicides. There's always the fear that genetically engineered organisms will reproduce by themselves in the environment, causing unforeseen harm. Looking forward, Professor Hodges is optimistic. He believes new genetically engineered plants can produce more food with less inputs, and that chemical use in agriculture will go down.
There should be a reduction in the use of chemicals. Chemicals like insecticides should go down. And the reason for that is that insect-resistant genes are being found all the time. And this year, for example, there is insect-resistant corn and insect-resistant cotton being grown in the United States that's been developed by genetic engineering. And the use of chemicals to control the insects in both crops has gone way down. So it's my belief that the genetic engineering will have a very favorable effect on the environment.
Tom Hodges is professor of plant physiology at Purdue University. We're talking Green and the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're discussing electric vehicles with a couple of experts. Daniel Sperling, professor of civil engineering and environmental studies at the University of California at Davis, and Bob Batson, president of Electric Vehicles of America, which is located in Massachusetts. Let's hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. And our email address is envshow@aol.com. Professor Sperling, let's start with you. Will the ordinary American ever want to either own or drive an electric vehicle?
Oh, I think, first of all, when we talk about electric vehicles, we should talk about the family of electric drive vehicles. And most people, when they say electric vehicles, they're really referring to battery-powered electric vehicles. There's also the hybrid-powered vehicles that have batteries and ultracapacitors and flywheels, as well as an internal combustion engine, and also possibly including fuel cells, and all powered by electric motors. But if your question is about battery-powered electric vehicles, I believe very strongly that there's a significant market niche for these vehicles, that there will be a substantial number of them in the future, and the challenge is, one, to bring down the cost, and two, to understand better the marketplace so that they can be marketed appropriately.
Well, Bob Batson, is the battery-powered vehicle the place to go? One hears that there are better alternatives than batteries, and maybe the battery vehicle is just something that's a passing phase.
I think initially it will be the battery-powered vehicle. Other things will come into play as the technology develops. But with today's technology, the battery-operated vehicle will be the leader.
Well, let me ask you something about that. We hear a lot about lead acid and how heavy it is, and I gather that's what the major manufacturers are now putting in the electric vehicles they're manufacturing. And yet, aren't there other alternatives? Didn't I see that one of the Japanese manufacturers was coming out with an alternative battery that was lighter and more efficient?
There's a number of prototype batteries under development, but like all things, until there's demand, there just isn't going to be the production. And so today, we'll be using the lead-acid battery. The advantage is, I'd like to draw an analogy to the personal computer industry. You know, when it started out, very slow and very limited memory, and that's exactly where we are with the electric vehicle. Technology is going to change all that, and that's what's going to happen in the next decade or two.
Well, let's go to the phones. I see we have a call from Albany, New York. Jan, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Hi. I have a couple questions that relate actually to the cost of things. And the first one is, it deals with electric cars. And I was wondering the actual cost or how clean they are, because the idea of where does the electricity come from? What about pollution? You've got to burn fossil fuel to get the electricity. You've got to use nuclear power. And so is the total pollution balance, I guess you could call it, more or less for an electric car? I mean, it's clean in California, but then we get the acid rain. And secondly, which also goes a little bit along with this, is solar power. Is it really more expensive? Because with the fossil fuels, you've got to clean up and there's a lot of health problems. Whereas once you get through, it seems like with the initial capitalization for solar power, you've got it more or less free and clear, relatively.
Well, let's focus on the generated electricity from fossil fuels for automobiles. What do our panelists think about that? Are we simply shifting the location of pollution from the automobile to the power plant?
In almost all situations, not all, but in almost all situations, the net reduction in pollution is large when you use battery-powered electric vehicles. And the reasons for that are several. One is that power plants are easier to control. One big electric generating power plant is easier to control than millions of small vehicles. And the problems we have with these small vehicles is the emission control systems deteriorate over time when you have a gasoline engine.
And of course, Jan, you raise a good point, because in the Northeast, we get hit with the acid rain or the deposition which comes out of coal plants in Ohio. Thanks for your call, though. That's
Thank
an
you.
Issue that a lot of folk have raised. Let's go to Nancy from Massachusetts.
Nancy. Oh, yes. My question actually has quite a bit connected with Jan's, but maybe a different twist to it, and I have two parts to my questions. It has to do with the economics of electric vehicles. People keep talking about how expensive electric vehicles are, and I wondered if you could talk about the economic benefits of EVs as you see them, and are they a good investment today or for the long run? And the second part of my question has to do, again, with the electric utilities and how the electricity is generated. And how important is it that we move towards green electricity, in other words, electricity that's generated from renewable technology, such as wind and solar, to power the EVs of the future? And what are the economic implications for the U.S. to make this decision in this move?
Well, Bob, let's start with you.
The economic benefit of the electric vehicle at this point in time, it's very difficult to justify. An electric vehicle. Otherwise, we'd all be having them. But again, it's one of those things where the vehicle is not really in production to the same standpoint of internal combustion vehicles. And that's going to take some time and some, again, some changes in technology. That can occur very rapidly. As every major automobile manufacturer in the world is pursuing electric vehicles, because pollution is a worldwide problem.
Let's go to the phones again. Bob Davis, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. What is your connection with the electric car game?
I'm the executive engineer at Chrysler Corporation in charge of electric vehicle development.
So you know something about this, and in fact, I think
I hope I do.
Your customers, if they're stuck on the side of the road, are going to call you first.
Okay.
The fact is, you guys have just marketed a vehicle, have you not?
Well, we have, and we started in 1993 with our first ones, which we codenamed the TE Van. We sold them as Dodge Caravan Electrics, and in three model years, we sold 56 of them, mainly to electric utilities. And now we're coming out with a new version based on our new minivan, which is... really been quite a vehicle. We got Motor Trend's Car of the Year award for a minivan, first thing out of the box. So it will be coming out in 1998, and it will be a vehicle called the Epic.
And
stands for Electric Powered Interurban Commuter.
And who are you going to sell these things to?
I think we're probably going to sell them mainly to electric utilities, government fleets. That's our first group of people that will probably buy them. See, the electric is something that works really well if you can run a route every day and then the guy plugs it in and drives his own car home at night. But it's not for the person who's going to go in and say, maybe I'll buy an electric minivan instead of a gasoline-powered one, because he can't take his family on vacation, a few things like that.
So, Bob Batson, would you buy one of these machines?
Pardon?
Would you buy one of these machines that Bob Davis is telling us about?
It sounds great. The only question is whether or not it's affordable by the individual.
And that's a real question, isn't it? I've got too many Bobs here. Bob Davis,
yeah.
What is the asking price for one of these Chrysler machines now?
We haven't priced it. We sold the original ones at $120,000 each, which has sort of covered our variable costs on it. Didn't include any of the engineering work or anything like that. And then we dropped it to $100,000 after we made some changes in it. And the first ones that we have committed to with the GSA, we've sold those at $45,000. And,
Price is dropping, but it's still
it's
high.
It's dropping, but I think you'll find it's still going to be about three times more than a gasoline vehicle.
Bob Davis from Chrysler, while you're on the phone, let me ask all three of you a question. Would anybody be making these things if it weren't for the EPA mandate that says that in some areas we've got to be selling a specific proportion of vehicles because of clean air problems?
It's Bob Davis from Chrysler. I think, again, it would probably be more of a research venture than actual try to sell them venture, because the battery technology just isn't there today. Now that may change in the future, because we're putting a lot of money into battery research through the United States Advanced Battery Consortium. So likely something will improve, but at this stage, no. Even our best vehicle that we're coming out with has a range of about 60 miles under ideal conditions. And that doesn't satisfy too many people. So I think it'll probably be more of a research project until there's some sort of breakthrough in the battery. And that might lead to more of a market for the vehicles themselves.
Do the rest of you agree with that, or will a hypercar, which generates its electricity on board and has small batteries, simply leapfrog the battery car that that Chrysler is now putting out?
No, I don't think it'll leapfrog it. I think we should look at the battery vehicle as being the foundation for electric drive vehicles. It's the first necessary step, and I don't think it's a step that's going to disappear. It's going to stay in place, because batteries are going to continue to play a role, and there will be a niche for vehicles that are strictly powered by batteries. I'd also like to comment that there are other companies with different strategies than Chrysler. GM, for instance, with their EV1, which they just unveiled December 5th, has made it very clear that they look at this as a business venture. this is not something they're doing just to meet a requirement or a standard. They're planning on making money on it. And perhaps they won't with the first generation vehicles, but that's their long-term strategy. And I'd also comment that Toyota has just announced that they are now spending half of their entire R&D budget on electric vehicles and other non-gasoline, non-petroleum vehicles and engines. And that accounts, by the way, for about $800 million a year. So these are companies. The automobile industry is very competitive these days, and companies are looking for an edge, and they realize the environmental benefits are being highly valued. And so companies such as GM and Toyota and some others are saying, we want to be the leaders. We think there's a real good chance that this technology is going to dominate. This electric drive vehicle technology will be dominant in the future. We're not sure how soon, but we want to get started down that path.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both. We've been joined by Dan Sperling, who is a professor of civil engineering at UC Davis, and Bob Batson, who is president of Electric Vehicles of America, located in Massachusetts. You're Talking Green on the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley, and our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. 888-49-GREEN. We'd like to hear from you. Thank you both. Thomas Michael Power is an economist who is professor and chair of the economics department at the University of Montana. He's just written a book called Lost Landscapes and Failed Economics, published by the Island Press. I reached him in Missoula. Professor Power, your book is a scathing indictment of conventional wisdom that predominates in many parts of the country, specifically that logging and mining and agriculture provide a sound bulwark for local economies. Are the people who believe that wrong?
Yeah, and I think part of them, part of their brain, probably knows that they're wrong. I think almost all of us, when challenged to name a prosperous logging town or a prosperous mining town or a prosperous agricultural town, would be really hard-pressed to find one, yet we're told those industries are a primary source of prosperity, especially for our rural areas. So there's a real conflict between the claims that are regularly made and widely received and what we all observe and what the data clearly indicates.
And clearly, as an economist, you make a persuasive case that this just doesn't pay when you look at all of the costs. If that is so clear, and certainly your book makes it so, why have we gotten to the point where we are, where after 150 years of development in the West, we're still doing it?
Well, I think part of it is that our understanding of where our livelihoods come from is tied not so much to current economic reality, or economic trends or facts, but it's tied to cultural values that are rooted in the past. And the result is that we make local economic policy based on sort of a hypnotic stare into the rearview mirror. We're looking backwards as we try to cope with the present and the future.
And so that then would put ultimately a higher premium on the kind of scenic and recreational resources that most people associate with the Northwest.
Absolutely, and it's not just the Northwest. I think one can find that throughout the rural United States as well as in our smaller cities and some of our larger cities. The quality of the living environment, the attractiveness of the living environment, its ability to attract and hold people and business firms is becoming a crucial element in the local area's economic base.
Now, one of the things that I thought was interesting about your book is your analysis of the service sector and the conventional wisdom about how service jobs are low paid, fluctuate highly, and basically lead you nowhere. Your view is somewhat different.
Absolutely. I think the problem with the conventional analysis is indicated by the symbol that's usually used for service jobs, which is a burger flipper. A burger flipper is not a service industry job. It's a retail trade job, and retail trade jobs are among the lowest paid jobs in the United States. But that is not what's growing by leaps and bounds. What's growing is business services, medical services, educational services, computer services, engineering and management services, legal services. Those bear no relationship to a burger flipper whatsoever. They're jobs that require advanced education or training that uses considerable skills that the workers have to have and are reasonably well paid.
You're referring to professors like yourself and lawyers like myself. There are, of course, those who would say that the burger flippers get more done, but we will we'll leave that to some other analysis.
Or at least produce a more valuable product.
Professor Power is author of a new book about the failed economics of the extractive industries in the Northwest. It's called Lost Landscapes and Failed Economics, The Search for the Value of Place. As communities in the western U.S. contemplate whether trees are worth more standing or on a logging truck, singer-songwriter Bruce Coburn is concerned about the destruction of the Amazonian rainforest. Coburn has been singing about the earth since his early days as a folk singer in Canada. Like most of his albums, Coburn's 1988 release, Big Circumstance, contains several songs about the environment. The song, If a Tree Falls, calls attention to the destruction of the world's great rainforests.
Rainforest, mist and mystery, teeming green. Green brain facing the bottom. Climate Control Center for the World. Ancient cord coexistence hacked by parasitic greedhead scam. From Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills, cortege rhythm of falling timber. What kind of currency grows in these new deserts, these brand new floodplains? Wildlife at a rate of a species every single day. Take out people who've lived with this for 100,000 years. Inject a billion burgers worth of beef. Grain eaters. Methane dispensers. Through thinning ozone, fall on wrinkled earth, gravity, light, ancient refuse of stars, speak of a drowning. But this is something other. Busy monster eats dark holes in the spirit world, where wild things have to go to disappear forever.
If a Tree Falls, by Canadian artist Bruce Coburn, from his 1988 release, Big Circumstance. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berlich. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 369. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, and the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues. Also, Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.